I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The night before the Senate votes on his impeachment, President Trump delivered his third State of the Union address last night to a bitterly divided and increasingly partisan Congress, touting what he called the Great American Comeback. There were Republican chants of four more years. Several Democrats walked out during the speech. The president did not shake Speaker Pelosi's outstretched hand at the start, and she ripped up his speech when he was done. Part campaign rally, part game show, President Trump announced a scholarship for a little girl from Philadelphia, orchestrated the tearful reunion of a military family, and gave the Presidential Medal of Freedom to talk show host Rush Limbaugh. He also said a number of false and misleading statements about protecting pre-existing conditions, real wages, and economic growth. According to Gallup poll, though, Trump is enjoying his highest approval rating at 49%. We asked John Brabender and Joe Watkins to join us on Radio Times. John is a Republican strategist, chief creative officer at Brabender Cox. That's a political and public affairs media firm across the state here in Pennsylvania. John, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, always happy to be here.
Also with us, as I said, Joe Watkins. He's a commentator for MSNBC. He worked in the White House, of President George Herbert Walker Bush as an aide, wrote a book called The New PC, Practical Consideration. Joe Watkins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, you can join the conversation. We want to know what you thought of last night's State of the Union. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Joe, let me begin with you. How much, and there was a lot of rancor, there was a lot of division on display last night, no question about it. How much of that, though, do you think is the responsibility of the President of the United States?
Well, I think that the President played to the larger audience, which was the television audience. It was everybody watching at home. And for millions of Americans who may not be as tuned in to all the signals that played out last night for people who have been in this a long time and who caught those signals, there's a lot of division. The country is pretty divided, and clearly the Congress is very divided, and to the point where it's hard for Democrats to clap for the president, and hard for Republicans to not cheer him, and it was pretty bitter. Nancy Pelosi ripping up the State of the Union address afterwards was seen, I think, by most people watching. But I think the president certainly touched all hit all the right signals for people watching. I mean, and I think what he sought to do was to go after groups that might not be inclined to support him. He clearly sent a number of signals to African American voters who do not vote with the president in large numbers by pointing out the little boy who wants to be an astronaut one day,
right,
by
like his great grandfather,
the promoting him to general as a former Tuskegee Airman, promoting him to general at the age of 100. Clearly, by recognizing the fact that since reform has been done for people of color, and then by having that little fourth grade girl from Philadelphia receive an opportunity scholarship on national television during the State of the Union, all those were clearly signals to the to communities of color that the president is sensitive, certainly more sensitive than he comes off as being, mentioning Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and talking about civil rights and the like. The president knows he won't get big numbers of blacks to vote for him, but if he can shave off a few points, that works to his favor, especially if the Democrats don't end up with a nominee that doesn't excite African-American voters in November.
Well, John, let me get you in on the conversation. And what do you make of the kind of enmity between the president and Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi?
Well, look, I actually think it was an unforced error by Pelosi. I think what she was trying to do is actually play to her Democrat members in the audience and show that she was going to be standing up for them and against Trump. I think she actually made the president look very presidential versus what she did in ripping up the the speech afterwards. So I really think it was an unforced error that made the president look much better than it did with her. But I want to go back to some of the things that Joe was saying, because I think this is really important. Donald Trump was talking to a lot of audiences that are going to be critical to this presidential election, and particularly African-American voters. You know, if you remember back in 2016, Donald Trump said, look, what do you have to lose? What has the Democrat Party done for you? And I think what he's coming back now and saying, this is an all-inclusive economy that I created. I did not forget about you, and I'm not going to forget about you. And I think that's a very powerful message, because traditionally, Republicans in presidential races get only about 7 or 8% of the African-American vote. You change that to 13-14% of the African-American vote, and you have probably dramatically changed the calculus of the final results.
Well, John,
I
was going to say, how though do you reconcile what the president said last night with what he has said about African countries? What he said about Baltimore, where Elijah Cummings was the representative? How do you reconcile those two very different messages then?
Well, it's interesting because, again, I find that with this president, everything is contextual. What do you think about the president decides how you respond to certain remarks. I think what he was saying about Baltimore is it was a disgrace that the African-American community was forced to live in a lot of the poverty and other things that we saw the dirty streets. We saw all these things that he said that's an outrage. And I think, whereas it sounded like he was criticizing the African-American community to some, I think he was criticizing a lot of the Baltimore leaders, saying, once again, this is a group of Americans that are being ignored. We're leaving them on the economic battlefield. He's saying the same thing about education with school choice. Why should lower income houses or African-American households or households with poverty always have to go to the worst schools? Why can't we give them some choices? And that was the other interesting thing I think he did last night. If you noticed, he put a lot of faces on these things. These weren't just things where he's saying, I want to do this. He actually had people there where he can say, let me show you the people that have been impacted either by what I have done or what I am going to do. And I think that is very powerful. And I think it shows this president, you know, regardless what you think of him, I think you have to agree he understands how to use digital. He understands how to use TV. He understands how to use these as a modern medium in a much different way than any politician we've had in American history.
Joe, let me go back to you. And there are parts of the economy that the president, I believe, could legitimately tout as doing well. He, though, talks about the biggest, the best. He exaggerates the successes that he has. That gets the fact checkers working. And I have a list of from the Washington Post and some other organizations, news organizations, that have ripped apart a number of the things that he has said. And I do believe legitimately ripped apart, for instance, on pre-existing conditions. The president is not protecting pre-existing conditions. He wants to undo the Affordable Care Act.
Well, Marty, you're right. There's lots to be fact-checked, and I'm sure there were things that were said that may not hold up under fact-checking, but the president is savvy enough to know, as somebody who's been on television, that if you say it, people will hear it and will believe it. And clearly, once it's said, there'll be very, very few people that'll follow up to see if the facts match up. So whatever the factual errancies there may have been last night, for the most part, he won't be punished by the public for those. The public will.
They don't care. They don't care.
No, they don't. No, they don't. I've been in this game a long, long time, and I've seen people publish retractions and corrections and make updates. But once something's been said, whether good or bad, I mean, the damage is done, and that's what people tend to believe. So I think the president ends up winning on that fact. He said it, people heard it, and if it's not true, only a small percentage of people will read that. And for the most part, it's not going to move the numbers. African Americans have not been happy with the president in general. But at the end of the day, John Brabender is absolutely right. If he was getting about 7 or 8 or 9% before of the black vote, if he's able to shave off another 5, 6, 7% from African Americans who like what he's doing with prison reform, or like what he's doing with regards to black unemployment, or like what he's doing with regards to school choice, or even naming black people in strategic places to be generals or to various other positions, that's a huge win for him. And it's doubled by what James Carville worries about, which is that if the Democrats don't nominate a candidate who excites African Americans, realizing that in order for Democrats to be competitive in this cycle, there needs to be a huge African American turnout, that's a problem. If Joe Biden is not the nominee, if there's it's hard to say that there's any other Democrat right now who can excite African American voters, who can get black people to show up to vote in
election day. But are you saying that President Trump could be more popular among black voters than, let's say, Joe Biden, Joe?
No. No, I don't say that. Not at all. My point is that if the president is successful in shaving off another 5 or 6 points among black voters, and as well the Democrats don't nominate somebody who really excites black voters, that's a problem for mm-hmm. Democrats. And that's what James Carville is worried about. That's what a number of Democrats are worried about. Joe Biden has the capacity, of course, to get strong black support. But he came in fourth in Iowa. Yeah. And if he doesn't show strongly in Nevada and South Carolina, where he has big bets, he's got a big problem, and the party has an even bigger problem.
Well, John, let me read a comment from Stephanie, who says Trump doesn't care about black people. He goes on and on about how he's helping them, but then he gives the Medal of Honor to Rush Limbaugh. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, yeah, I think that's a pretty broad jump. I'm not going to weigh into where I think Rush Limbaugh is on the progression of African Americans, because I have no idea. But I will say this: it is indisputable that the president has done a lot on the area of criminal justice reform, which is so important to the African American community. In fact, the president put his money where his mouth is and ran about $5 million in TV advertising promoting that during the Super Bowl to let everybody know what he's accomplished. And so, I think you have to be very, very careful to try to judge people by others that may be supporters of theirs or around them. I think end of the day, I think people are going to look at the facts. And I still think that there's a lot of African Americans in this country who feel that both party for the last, two decades at least have let them down. And I think that for the first time, they may look and say, look, our unemployment numbers are better. Criminal justice reform is being done. We might, and a lot of people, frankly, don't like the tone and tenor of this president, regardless of what your race is, regardless what party you are. But a lot of people are going to look at this and say he was an agent of change, which is what we wanted, to go clean up a mess of this divisive corruption in Washington. And you can't argue against the facts that he's accomplished a lot of what people were hoping he would accomplish,
John,
even if they're not always happy with how he got there.
We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about President Trump's State of the Union address last night with Joe Watkins. He's a commentator for MSNBC, worked in the George Herbert Walker Bush White House. Also with us, John Brabender. He's a Republican strategist and chief creative officer at Brabender Cox. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Joe, I just want to follow up on what talk about criminal justice reform, certainly the president has made some changes in criminal justice. But I think you have to also have to recognize that a lot of that is happening at the city level. I'm thinking here in Philadelphia, the district attorney, Larry Krasner, what he has done in concert with the mayor of the city, and I think it's true in other cities as well, is that they have also addressed this issue of criminal justice reform at a very sort of granular level.
Yeah, absolutely right. That's a good thing. And I think it's encouraging for people of color, since people of color like me are disproportionately affected by sentencing, by lengthy sentences and unfair sentences. But again, John Brabender's point is very, very key, which is that the visual really matters. And I was watching the Super Bowl, like I'm sure millions of other people, and I saw the commercial that showed an African-American woman thanking the president for getting her freed from prison. She had received a life sentence for something that she had done, and because of the criminal justice reform, she was freed from prison, and she personally thanked President Trump. That's a very, very powerful testimony to people watching, to see that, to see a black family embracing her and to see her saying, "I thank the president for what he's done." And again, it's not going to give the president a majority of black votes, not even close. But again, if he shaves off 5, 6, 7, or 8% of African Americans in the fall election, that's really critical for him.
Let me put something else on the table. John Brabender, the Senate will vote this afternoon on whether or not to acquit or impeach the president. It looks like acquittal is fairly certain. I would say probably 99% certain. What do you make of that? And do you think the Republican Party has bought into the president in a way where they could put their own future of the party at risk on the line?
Look, I look at somebody like a Susan Collins, who the Democrats thought for sure was going to vote to impeach this president. And she came out and gave a very thoughtful speech yesterday on the floor explaining why she's going to vote to acquit. And part of that was she criticized the process by the congressional Democrats. And so what's happened in reality here is this impeachment process has not changed a single vote in this country. Everybody knew how the vote was going to go in the House and how the vote was going to go in the Senate before we paid the millions and millions of dollars to have this happen. And it just, only thing that it solidified in people's mind was less about the president and more about how divided and partisan Washington is. And I think they grew tired of impeachment quickly. I don't think it'll be a factor in the 2020 election. And I think it's a shame, because just think about, between all these investigations, including impeachment, the Mueller investigation, everything, it's about $50 million. Just think what you could have done for the American people with $50 million that we no longer can do. And I think that's a real shame.
Well, Joe, we also have, and I think it's pretty clear that there will be more information that's going to leak out or be published in the next couple of months related to what the president did with Ukraine to go after his rival, Joe Biden, and to invite foreign interference. You've got John Bolton essentially jumping up and down, waving his hands to the Senate, saying, subpoena me, and I will come in and tell you what I know firsthand. Is the Republican Party at risk by, in a sense, exonerating the president?
Well, you would think that would be the case, but all you have to do is look at the poll numbers, and the polling numbers haven't moved. Even the ratings for the impeachment process series on television tells you the lack of strong interest on the part of most Americans. And as long as those polls didn't move, you weren't going to see any movement on the part of Republican senators in this trial. So I think that new information will likely come out, and it'll make news, and it'll be something that we talk about. But it won't move the numbers. It's not going to change the polling numbers. And ultimately, the president will be unaffected by it.
I mean, do you think things are just pretty much then cemented today, Joe, about what's going to happen in November?
I think a lot of it is. I mean, I think that for the most part, people have already chosen sides, and then for those people who haven't chosen sides, a lot will depend on who the nominee is on the Democratic side. I mean, there are Republicans and Democrats who are looking to see what the Democrats are going to do, and there are African Americans that are looking to see who the Democratic nominee is going to be, and a lot of that has to do with whether or not they're going to be really interested in coming out and campaigning and then show up to vote on Election Day. And James Carville made this general point just recently on television, where he said he's scared to death of the Democratic Party because he doesn't like the direction in which it's going, and he's not happy about the fighting between progressives and moderates in the Democratic Party, and he thinks it's just disastrous. He says at the end of the day, if Democrats don't have power, they don't have anything, and that would be true. So I would give the advantage right now to President Trump as it stands today in February of 2020. Clearly the advantage is his.
John, final question, then we have to say goodbye to both of you. Do you think the president will engage in the debates no matter who the Democrat is?
I mean, look, this president engages in anything through Twitter. I mean, we have to understand his followers are probably equal to CNN, Fox, and MSNBC viewers combined. You know, so he has this powerful medium. So he's going to be engaged not only in the debates in the fall, whoever his opponent is, he's going to be engaged in all the debates by the Democrats moving forward. And, you know, he's broken all the rules of how you get elected president. And, you know, that's what a disruptive president is. And that disruption can be very positive if done right. You know, anything is possible with President Trump because he does not follow, as we know, the traditional rules and norms. And so I think you're going to be hearing a lot about from him during this Democrat process. So,
and if it's done wrong, what are the implications, John?
Well, look, I actually think he's become much better at this. In fact, I think all of us would agree that his polling numbers would even be higher if he changed his tone and tenor often. You know, the numbers that are holding up his reelection are not based on accomplishments. They're based on sometimes personal conduct that others find offensive. That is just who this president is. But on the other hand, if you were to just come in and look at accomplishments, you would think that his favorability rating would be well into the 60s. The other thing we have to understand in elections, everything changes once you have an opponent. You know, neither Hillary Clinton nor Donald Trump had particularly great favorable numbers on Election Day, but Donald Trump still could win. And so I think the Democrat and the Republican on Election Day will have very high unfavorables, both of them, because that's just the times that we live in, because we are so divided, and the extreme ends of both spectrum are probably the strongest in each party.
John, just a quick question, because you've said this several times during the interview. Instead of saying Democratic candidate, you say Democrat candidate. How come? What are you trying to tell us?
Yeah, I'm not. It's probably poor grammar on my part rather than any particular intellectual insight.
Are you sure about that?
My subtleness isn't. You're not catching me at some unique subtleness.
No, I'm not.
But I will tell you. You know, even entering into these conversations, this is the thing that we as a country now are talking about, the politics of it. There was something very important last night that I've yet to see one person talk about, and that was that Donald Trump offered an olive branch to Iran during his speech last night. We were almost at war with them 30 days ago, yet that got through the whole process without anybody talking about it. But Nancy Pelosi ripping up papers is what everybody wants to talk about today. Mm-hmm. And that tells more about the environment that we are all working in right now, the divisive nature, than it does about anything else.
Well, we have to leave it there. John Brabender, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And Joe Watkins, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks so much, Marty.
You're welcome. Well, from the State of the Union and impeachment to the spectacular caucus failure in Iowa, we still do not have the final results from Monday's caucuses. With about 70% of the votes counted, Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders are pretty much neck and neck, followed by Elizabeth Warren and then Joe Biden coming in fourth. By all accounts, there were problems with the new app, with little or no training for the volunteers, and jammed phone lines. The Democratic candidates are now in New Hampshire for the first primary of the election season, which is next week. Molly Ball just returned from Iowa. She wrote the Time cover story about Vice President Joe Biden. She's national political correspondent for Time, a political analyst for CNN, and she's working on a book about Nancy Pelosi, joining us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor. And Molly Ball, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let's talk a little bit about what is going on in Iowa. And I think the level of incompetence is just breathtaking. What do you make of what's happening there in the Hawkeye State?
Well, as you said, we're still waiting for those final results to come out. There's been a lot of confusion. There was an app that the party was attempting to use for the first time, and it was sort of shrouded in secrecy, they said, for security reasons, but that meant that it hadn't really been tested. And a lot of the precinct chairs whose job it was to use the app to enter the results hadn't even downloaded it by the time the caucuses got started. So there were crashes, there were glitches. We don't think there were any actual irregularities in the results themselves. There were, you know, manual backups. All of this is recorded on paper.
Right.
And as you said, they didn't have the phone line capacity to take in all of those results as the caucuses were happening on Monday night. But they are tabulating them now, and they've been releasing them bit by bit. And it does appear to be the case, as you said, that Pete Buttigieg has the slight edge in state delegate equivalents, which are the official metric of victory, almost akin to an electoral college versus popular vote. And it looks like the New York Times is projecting that Bernie Sanders will have the most raw votes, the sort of popular vote metric there. So I think it allows both of those candidates to claim victory. And it really does reset this race. This is not, I think, where we thought the Democratic primary was going to be going into New Hampshire. And it's going to be a very interesting week ahead as the candidates go into that next primary.
And I do want to get to that. But do you think Iowa's experiment with caucusing has come to and even beyond what happened with the app problem, but just when you really dig down into how people vote in Iowa, it doesn't seem particularly democratic.
Well, this is a system, parties control their own nominating systems. It doesn't have to be democratic. It's up to the political parties. And
right.
It was really only 50 years ago that voters had actually very little say in the party's nominees. And this system of primaries and caucuses going around the country has evolved from that. I think people don't necessarily understand how new and how evolving this system continues to be. There have been problems with the Iowa caucuses in previous
yep.
years. In 2012, the Republican winner wasn't declared for weeks after the vote. In 2016, it was several days of confusion between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. I've heard from some people saying, so we have to wait a couple days for the results. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't look like anything went wrong with the vote itself. And this is a sort of hallowed tradition that has its pluses and minuses, as you say. On the one hand, there are people who can't participate in a caucus, and that always causes some accusations of unfairness. On the other hand, it's a unique system that allows neighbors to get together and talk to each other and sort of hash this out as a community, as a party. It empowers some of probably the most motivated activists versus those people who might just show up and cast a vote in a primary. So there are pluses and minuses to every system. And I think although there are calls to take this away from Iowa now, it's premature to predict that's going to happen.
So what do you make of these top-tier candidates? You've got Pete Buttigieg on one hand. You've got Bernie Sanders on the other hand. You've got a centrist and a liberal. And then you go down to the next level. You've got Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden, again, a liberal and a centrist. What do you make of that?
It's very interesting, as you say, matchup. We have these two kind of lanes of candidates, the progressives and the moderates. And I think that was clear going in. But what we didn't know was that Biden would fall so far short.
Yeah.
You know, he's the front runner in the national polling. He's been considered sort of the man to beat, the odds on nominee. And yet he performed very poorly here, I think, below expectations, including his own. And that And that reflects some of his weaknesses as a candidate, and it shows that the sort of establishment of the Democratic Party is in disarray, is in confusion, doesn't have a clear nominee to rally around. It'll be interesting to see over the next week if Pete Buttigieg is able to position himself as the consensus candidate of the sort of moderate or establishment mainstream of the Democratic Party. And then you have Bernie Sanders really surging, and I think he's been underestimated in a lot of ways, too. He did quite well and is predicted to do quite well in New Hampshire. And, you know, his campaign is very much more advanced than it was 4 years ago when he surprised a lot of people by making such a strong show against Hillary Clinton. He's really managed, he's expanded his appeal in a lot of ways, done a lot of organizing on the ground. At the same time, the turnout in these caucuses was pretty low. So the predictions that someone like a Bernie Sanders, through his aggressive organizing drive, could bring in a lot of new voters, bring a lot of people into the process, that doesn't seem to have happened. So all of this is feeding, you know, the Democratic angst about all, every Democrat is desperate to beat Donald Trump in November. But there's no consensus about how is the best way to do that, who is the best candidate to do that. And it's really a mess right now. And and there's a lot of ground to cover before we get to a nominee.
Well, I read your cover story of Joe Biden. It's really interesting. Lots of interesting tidbits in there and some analysis as well. And I think for most people, myself included, I've watched him on the debate stage. And he clearly fumbles and struggles to find words and is not quite as fresh as the other candidates in terms of talking about what he believes in, what his policies are. You followed him around on the campaign trail. What did you see?
I think, you know, sometimes Joe Biden is really on, and you do see flashes of that very sharp candidate that he was back in 2008, back in 1988. He's been on the scene for a long time, run for president twice before. And then sometimes he's off, and you do see him, as you said, meandering, trying to find the end of a sentence, seeming almost a little bit lost in his own thoughts. So, if you were on the ground in Iowa following Joe Biden and the other candidates around, it was really striking how much more subdued his events were than the other candidates. The crowds tended to be smaller. They tended to be a lot older. Just the level of enthusiasm, of exuberance in the room tended to be remarkably low compared to really any of the other top candidates who were drawing big, enthusiastic crowds and who were giving rah-rah speeches, getting people on their feet, getting people excited. And so that seems to have played out in the results of the caucuses, that in a lot of places there weren't enough Joe Biden supporters even to make him viable for the delegate count. And then in this complicated process of the caucuses where voters realign a second time, he lost even more support as those supporters went to other candidates. So not a good sign for Joe Biden as he heads into New Hampshire.
Molly Ball. She's a national political correspondent for Time. Wrote a cover story about Vice President Joe Biden for Time. She's a political analyst for CNN, working on a book about Nancy Pelosi. We are talking about the Iowa caucus. A tweet, the Iowa caucus was not a fiasco or chaos. Voting went perfectly. It was a new post-voting reporting system that failed.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and if you are just joining us, Molly Ball is our guest. She's national political correspondent for Time, a political analyst for CNN, working on a book about Nancy Pelosi, and just got back from Iowa, where she was following the candidates around, has a cover story on Joe Biden for Time. How much, Molly, do you think the fact that Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, that their name came up so many times during the impeachment hearing, the impeachment trial, how much has that put the campaign on the defensive or even tarnished the campaign? I should say that no wrongdoing has ever been found. But nonetheless, the Republicans are certainly using Joe Biden to kind of beat him up.
Yeah, it was something that you did hear about that voters brought up with Joe Biden and with other candidates on the trail. There were a couple times that Biden got asked a question about it in the events that I attended. And then some supporters of other candidates said one of their worries about Biden, you know, Biden's main argument has been that he's the most electable candidate. And I had several voters on the ground in Iowa say, you know, I'm worried that with this scandal, even if I think it's based on lies and conspiracy theories, that Trump will capitalize on it to beat up Biden and to do to him sort of what Democrats believe was done to Hillary Clinton, where these sort of vague insinuations of corruption, no matter how unfounded, contributed to tarring the nominee in the eyes of a lot of voters and made it much more difficult to beat Trump, particularly with a message about corruption, since so many Democrats believe that that is going to be one of their strongest arguments in November. They want a nominee who can make that case authoritatively and without their own baggage.
Here's a Facebook comment for Frank who says Democrats should not let the Iowa snafu become a Trump party talking point. Trump is just hoping to use this to distract from his own corruption and incompetence. And the president really didn't say anything last night during the State of the Union about what was going on in Iowa. But one can only anticipate that he will once things get underway. And he certainly has tweeted about it.
He's tweeted about it. He tweeted about it again this morning. This has become a Republican talking point. How can you trust Democrats to run the country when they can't even run a caucus? We'll see if this is something anybody remembers, you know, a few weeks or a few months from now. It may be one of those things that sort of vanishes into memory. But it certainly is true that I think, you know, you think back to something like healthcare.gov, right, when the Obama administration wasn't able to get that website up to implement the Affordable Care Act. And it was a similar thing when Democrats really want to run as the party of competence, the party of trust in government, the party of governance itself in a lot of ways. And it undermines that credibility somewhat when Republicans, you know, whether you agree with them or not, are able to point and say, well, you just can't trust the Democrats or the government to run things on a large scale.
Here's another question from our Facebook page. This one from Emily. Anyone bothered that Buttigieg has more delegates but Sanders has more popular votes? Why is this happening? And Molly, in many ways, this is how elections are tabulated in the United States.
Well, in Iowa specifically, and in a lot of states, actually, you know, it goes back to this antiquated system where once upon a time, people would gather in their own communities to elect delegates, and then those delegates would go to county conventions, and those delegates would go to a state convention, and those delegates would go to the national convention, and that's where they would decide who the presidential nominee was going to be. The system is much more democratic now than it used to be, much more transparent, but that does produce, you know, more awareness of the ways in which it is not a pure democracy. If it were, there would be a single nationwide vote, and that would decide the nomination. That is not how either party has decided to structure it at this point. So, you know, it is a little bit reminiscent of the Electoral College, but it also represents the different strategies of these campaigns. The Buttigieg campaign was very intentional about trying to organize in those places that had disproportionate amounts of delegates, particularly in rural areas. And they put a lot of emphasis on the what they call Obama-Trump counties and precincts, areas that, you know, that went for Barack Obama in 2012 and then swung to vote for Donald Trump in 2016. And they're trying to use this as part of their electability case to say, if we can flip these places in a primary, that means that we'll have a better shot at flipping them in a general election. They're obviously different electorates. That may or may not be true. But so I think you have that being part of the argument for Buttigieg, even as Sanders has put more emphasis on this idea of grassroots organizing and a sort of populist measure to say, well, we have the people on our side, we have the most votes.
And we do have some interesting counties in Pennsylvania that voted for Obama and then flipped to Trump. So it'll be interesting to see.
Absolutely.
Once all the candidates come to Pennsylvania to look for votes here. And again, Molly Ball, our guest. She is national political correspondent for Time. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Molly, what do you make of Elizabeth Warren, her rise, her fall, her rise, how her candidacy is going? And she seemed to be on the ascendance a couple of months ago and then seems to have fallen back into the, you know, third, maybe even fourth place. What do you make of that?
Yeah, she does look like she's going to come in a pretty solid third here, but she's another candidate who seems to have done better in the raw vote than she did in the delegate count and to have lost some supporters in that realignment process. Warren is in a difficult place because if you're thinking of the primary in terms of lanes, if you're thinking, you know, there's a liberal lane and a moderate lane, she's been very much overshadowed and outpaced by Bernie Sanders in that progressive lane. And for many months hasn't really differentiated herself from Sanders. I think there was an expectation at the very, very beginning, you know, a year ago when she first got in, that Sanders either might not run or might not be able to reclaim the loyalty of the voters who supported him last time. But indeed, Sanders did run. And indeed, his supporters have proven quite loyal and he's been able to expand his support in some ways. So that's made it harder for Warren to distinguish herself. In the days and weeks before the caucuses, she was trying to make a new argument. She was trying to argue that she was the unity candidate who could bridge some of the divides in the party, who could bring in both the moderates and the liberals. But that seems to be a role that Buttigieg has done a better job of consolidating. And so, you know, New Hampshire was once thought to be good territory for Warren, but it'll be interesting to see if she can actually make up some ground there now.
So do you think the Democratic Party is fracturing or just this is a wrestling match inside a bigger tent?
It's fractured, but that's the natural process of a primary. It's always the case that, you know, the candidates are going to be at each other's throats. There's going to be a lot of doubt and uncertainty. And in the end, they come together for better or worse. Is this primary going to be so acrimonious that it leaves lasting scars, that the supporters of one candidate who ends up losing won't come out to support whoever the nominee ends up being? That's always a possibility. And it's why you hear, you know, a lot of voters on the one hand will tell you, oh, you know, I love my candidate. I can't stand the others. It's so important that my candidate win. But on the other hand, they're tired of the fighting. They don't want the candidates to be at odds with each other because there is this desperate anxiety about being able to win in November. So I think what we're seeing is reflective of a lot of that angst. It's almost as if the party has been paralyzed by its anxiety over beating Trump. And, it'll probably get worse before it gets better as the candidates try to make that final sell. But it won't last forever.
Well, it's always interesting when the candidates do come together, whether they want to or not, or no matter how they feel about each other. But it often feels more raw among their supporters when their candidate is unable to get the votes that they need to get the nomination.
It's true. And you know, in 2016, Bernie Sanders did eventually concede to Hillary Clinton and he campaigned with her throughout the fall. But we see that there's still a lot of scar tissue there. You have Hillary Clinton out on her whatever tour she's on right now, making a lot of very cutting, disparaging comments about Sanders, and a lot of Sanders supporters who still have a lot of anger at what they feel was an unfair process in 2016. There's some evidence that some Sanders supporters stayed home or didn't vote for Hillary Clinton in the fall, and that may have contributed to her defeat. So there is a lot of acrimony there. These divisions don't always heal, even if the candidates themselves are able to come together. So I think we're going to hear a lot about that as these primaries continue. A lot of candidates trying to argue that the most important thing is coming together. They just, of course, can't agree on which one of them should be the one to do that.
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, Hillary Clinton talking about Bernie Sanders, she said nobody likes him. And she said other things that were equally disparaging. President Obama has been very mum on the sideline. What does that tell you?
Well, Obama was also neutral 4 years ago, and that's a pledge that he's made and clearly intends to keep. Biden, having been Obama's vice president, would seem to be the most obvious choice if he was going to endorse somebody. But he said, you know, it's not personal. Biden even actually claims that he didn't ask for Obama's endorsement. There's no doubt that if Obama were to wade into this, that would be extremely powerful. He's still a very, very popular figure with rank and file Democrats, even as there's been a lot of, reopening of his legacy and his policies, and they've been called up for reconsideration over the course of this primary. But I don't see any indication that he wants to do that. You know, speaking with people who are still close to him, speaking with former Obama administration officials, and if you think of the administration as bigger than just one person, one president, if you're looking at people around Obama and people in what we call the Democratic establishment, there's no consensus there either. There, a lot of them support Joe Biden, but not enough for him to be able to claim that, you know, the sort of unanimous support of the last administration. So we see a lot of disunity. We see, and I think Obama's silence reinforces this idea that the party does not have a clear direction.
And do you think South Carolina will be the real testing ground for then Joe Biden?
It seems likely that that's the case. Biden has always relied upon South Carolina as a sort of firewall, as a backstop for the two first states. I mean, one of Biden's greatest strengths is that he has very strong support, very strong loyalty from African-American voters who are really the backbone of the party in a lot of ways. And there are very few African-American voters in Iowa or New Hampshire. That's part of the criticism of those two states going first, is they are so overwhelmingly white. At the same time, momentum matters a lot, and we're already seeing a little bit of evidence that Biden's support may be falling off in South Carolina. The Bernie Sanders campaign has worked very hard to try to increase his support among African American voters over the past 4 years, that being one of his big weaknesses against Hillary Clinton in 2016. So it'll be very interesting to see before we get to South Carolina, as you know, there's more polls released and more events held there, whether that loyalty to Biden remains or whether voters reconsider based on what's been happening in Iowa and New Hampshire.
A comment from Jim. My understanding is that the new rules regarding delegates and the popular vote in Iowa are because of reforms that Sanders pushed. Molly, do you know the answer to that?
Well, yes and no. Yes, the release of these different numbers is because of those reforms. There were so many complaints that the process wasn't transparent last time around, so the party made the decision to release these three different sets of results for maximum transparency. Of course, in the end, that may end up confusing more than it clarifies, because it allows multiple candidates to claim victory by different metrics or to be able to spin the results in different ways. But yes, it was the Sanders and some of his backers and sort of progressives in the party who didn't like the way the process was run last time, and so argued for it to be more transparent this time.
Molly, just a couple of more minutes before I have to say goodbye. I want to ask you about Nancy Pelosi. You are writing a book about her. I see you have a cover and I guess a title as well. I was checking you out on Twitter. What do you make of what she did last night, ripping up the president's speech after it was delivered? She said it was the courteous thing to do considering the alternative. That's a quote from Nancy Pelosi. She called it a manifesto of mistruths. Was that her way of saying to him, you lie?
It's pretty much the equivalent of that, isn't it? I mean, the Democrats obviously did not like the State of the Union address. They felt that that Trump, you know, exaggerated and misrepresented a lot of things. And at the very beginning of the speech, we saw Trump refuse to shake Pelosi's outstretched hand. This comes at a time when the impeachment of the president is still underway until probably this afternoon. The House taking action to impeach him starting last year, and Trump speaking in the very chamber where that happened. So there's really no goodwill between the Democrats in the House and the president at this point. And we saw that play out in very dramatic fashion in those gestures that bookended the speech. Pelosi's aides have said that this was not calculated. This was not a strategy that she went in with. It appears to have been just a sort of spontaneous gesture of sort of reflecting her emotions about the speech and about this president.
Well, I was watching her and watching the president in that screen, and she was having a hard time containing her emotional facial reactions.
Yeah, she really did not have much of a poker face, no, did she? You could see her reacting. You could see her scanning, reading through the speech as he was talking, and sort of clearly disapproving of a lot of what she saw there, and which is again not surprising given the two poles of politics that those two figures occupy.
Well, Molly Ball, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's a national political correspondent for Time. Has a cover story on Vice President Joe Biden. She's also a political analyst for CNN. And as we have mentioned several times, she's working on a book about Nancy Pelosi. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can also always download a podcast of the show, especially if you miss the conversation. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.